global debt crisis, looking at who pays the cost. This is the second of a two-part series that I've been doing, and I know a number of you weren't at the first part, so hopefully we will can do some quick review, and also the stuff that we'll do will sort of stand on its own. Should introduce myself. I'm Barry Shelley. I presently am on staff at Holden as a program associate, and some people have asked me in the past, well, what credibility do you have to be speaking about the third world debt crisis? I guess just to say I do have some background in economics. I have a degree in public policy and have over the past few years done a lot of work on looking at the debt crisis and the whole sort of international economic system. I think beyond that, I would like to say and to sort of introduce this whole session by saying that I think all of us need to learn and be willing to take some more responsibility for economics. I think there's generally an economics phobia among most people, just like there's often math phobia and among some students. And what I think happens when we do that is we really sort of give up much of the responsibility that an input that we could have around some of the social injustice issues in our world, because I can't think of one social justice issue that doesn't in the end come down to something about economics. Not that that's the only part of it, but I really do think that there's also a level at which we can all understand something about economics to be involved in that process, even if we're not professional economists or even understand a lot of the details. So having said that, we tried to do this in the first session too, talk about the global debt crisis, which is a very complicated issue, but hopefully introduce that in a way that you may be interested in going and doing some further reading on it or talking to other people, as well as just being a little bit more aware when you see things in the newspaper about it, about what's going on. I want to begin, because the last time we ran out of time and I didn't have a chance to do this, just by mentioning a few resources, and some of these I'll refer to during this session. But that if you're interested in looking at some more of this stuff, you're welcome to come up here afterwards and look at any of this that you like. First of all, one book that we do not have, it's been ordered for the bookstore, but unfortunately it's not here. Probably one of the best sort of concise explanations of the whole debt problem and at least one viewpoint on alternatives, solutions, is put about the Institute of Policy Studies, which and written by the Debt Crisis Network, which is a coalition of different agencies involving churches as well who are dealing with the whole problem. It's called From Debt to Development. You have to forgive me because I don't have much of a voice the last few days. So that's, you can take a look at that. It can be ordered. It only costs about $3. The World Council of Churches has put out a little booklet called The Debt Crisis in the Third World, which is also very helpful and does a lot of stuff with even looking at the theology behind how we should respond. Also, the World Council of Churches has put out a little book on the international financial system and ecumenical critique, which is excellent. And again, doing that from a theological standpoint. And there are a couple of books. At the end of this session, we're going to be looking at not only the debt crisis, but how that sort of brings up issues about the whole international economic system. And several books that are available in the bookstore. Actually, this one's not. It's in the library. It's called Bread and Justice Towards a New International Economic Order by James McGinnis. It's very good. And three that are available in our bookstore are World Citizen, Action for Global Justice, which again is specifically primarily on economic system. Economic Justice for All, which is the Catholic Bishop's letter on the economy, which has a whole section in here on, I'm going to actually quote part of this in a little while, on the international economic system and refers to the debt crisis. And finally, a book that is it's called Economics and Ethics, A Christian Inquiry by Philip Wogeman is in there, and it really looks at a lot of different issues of economics. It includes this. He doesn't come down with a lot of very specific recommendations, all he does in some cases, but it's really more of an introduction to how we can, as people of faith, look at issues of economics. So those are things that you might want to look at, as well as I have some other articles up here in different, out of Christianity in Crisis and some other places. There's also a network quarterly publication that I'm a member of on the debt crisis, if anybody's interested in that. Okay, what I would like to do today is to very, very quickly review. It'll be review for some of you who are here the other day. For those who are new, just give a very quick introduction to what the debt crisis is and what the roots of the problem are. And then move from there to looking at what are some of the proposals that have been made for solving the problem in the short term. And then from there, very briefly looking at some things around sort of the whole international economic order and some of the things that I at least think we need to really look at. I would say to start with that while the debt crisis I think is a serious problem, especially for the poor people in the third world, it's here, and I think in some ways we can look at it as an opportunity for perhaps bringing about some reforms that some people have been talking about for decades and have never really happened. And it may just be that if developing countries in the world get together and push a little bit with the influence that they may have around defaulting on loans, that there may be some of that that's actually pushed through and maybe people will start listening to those. So that's at least one thing I want us to consider. Okay. Let me get out of the way here for a second. Basically, the debt crisis, it used to be more referred to the third world debt crisis, and I think now appropriately it's the global debt crisis, because even though it's a crisis based on the fact that it's third world countries who are the major debtors in this case that we're concerned about, people are starting to realize that it's affecting the entire globe. But in the last, this has primarily been loans since the mid-70s, some from 1973 on, and have doubled since 1980. But you can see that just this is an example of some of the larger debtor nations. Brazil is $108 billion, Mexico to 102, on down Indonesia 44, and you can see the list. That's amounts that are owned almost entirely to Western governments and Western commercial banks. Now, the real problem is shown when you start looking at what's called a debt service ratio, which is essentially the percentage of what it would take each year for these countries to pay on their debt service, what their actual amount of payment would be. As compared to the amount of income that they get from their exports. So that's a good idea of how healthy they are economically and how healthy the loans are. And you can see that several of these countries are having to spend 40% each year of their export earnings just to service their debt. Now that's where the real problem, that gives you some idea. Essentially, they can't pay it. And it's reached a point where people have started to realize that. And even I quoted Henry Kissinger the other day. I mean, even Henry Kissinger is saying the payments cannot be made. There's just no way that these countries, with the economies they have, can pay that. Yes?
What would be considered a normal ratio? Healthy ratio?
Below 10%.
Below 10%.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, well, we'll get into that in a minute, but some countries are actually now saying they won't pay any more than 10%. That's what Peru has said. Earl?
You mean service their debts, say interest and principal or just interest?
It's actually interest, and I made a mistake the other day. Somebody asked me that, and I, off the top of my head, said interest, but it's what If you had a loan that you, the amount that you had to pay each year, including the interest and the actual payment, what was due for your loan would be that amount. So people are sort of waking up, and it's been termed a crisis since 1982, when, you may remember, it got a lot of news coverage. Mexico all of a sudden said, we can't pay it. We don't have the money. And since that time, there have been about 6 other countries that have said the same thing. So that's sort of what the crisis is. Now, you know, what caused all of this? And again, I'm going to try to do this quickly, because some people have already, we've gone through this in detail, but I think I can give you a quick idea. I just listed 8 of the major things. And I think even though the crisis may not have been termed a crisis before 1982, and even though the loans involved with the crisis may not have been taken out before 1973, you really have to go back a couple hundred years to start understanding, which is that most of the third world economies are built on a colonial economic system, where their primary products are products that were designed to be sent back to first world countries, like sugar, tobacco, coffee, cotton, other raw materials as well. And that's still the case, even though most third world countries now are independent. You can't change your whole economy overnight. They haven't had the resources to do that. So most of their economies still are based on those major products. I'll say something more about that in a minute. A second problem is simply the fact that international agencies like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, Western governments have taken an approach to development. In other words, how do we go and help the third world develop economically? And the model for doing that has primarily been one of saying that you increase the gross national product, that you throw in a certain amount of capital, and that will create economic growth. And that is, and I would agree with that to a certain extent. I mean, that's, but it's been a little too simplistic, is what the critique would be made now by a lot of people. A lot of the controls have not, or a lot of the money has never ended up in development projects that really sustained any kind of economic growth. We could talk about more of that a lot and more, but that's just some idea. Things really started happening in 1973, when we had the oil prices jumping up. And what that did was, number one, it increased greatly the expenses of third world countries at the same time that it increased tremendously the money supply from the profits of oil that were going into Western banks. Most of the oil producing countries, the profits were not invested, or much of it was not invested in their own country. It was sent to Western banks and deposited, and are invested in other kinds of things. So bankers all of a sudden have a lot of money that's sitting in their banks that they're paying interest on. They're trying to get rid of it. And a lot of the loans then that they pushed, especially onto the third world market, were made without the standard criteria that loans had been made with before. And a lot of people would say they were very irresponsible loans. And the sort of the vision, though, I mean, there were, for some of those, they were very irresponsible. At the same time, others really had a vision that the 70s was going to be the time of great development in the third world. Here was this money. We're going to put it in there. We're going to let things happen. Fortunately, that didn't really happen that way. That particular time, interest rates were fairly low. But the interest rates were tied to the international, either the U.S. prime rate or the LIBOR rate, which is the London Interbank Interest Rate. They were not fixed interest rates. So they fluctuated, they floated with the market in the world. We'll see what happens with that in a minute. So all this money is going out to third world countries. Maybe I should even skip down to 5. Unfortunately, a lot of that money never again made it to really healthy development projects. A lot of it was lost to corruption. A lot of it was needed just to keep their infrastructure going. And a lot of it, a significant amount, was lost to capital flight. money that was taken out of their country by the wealthy and deposited, and again, back into the same banks it came from very often, so that they could personally make money. A lot of it also went into military use. Okay, so you don't have as much economic growth as you would like to try to keep up with the loans to start with. And then commodity prices, the things like sugar and tobacco and those things, have continued to fall all through the 70s. So they're not getting as much money from their exports as they need to pay off the loans. So that's putting them in a bind. And then finally, 1979, the Western powers, there was a recession. And a lot of that was intentional. The U.S. Federal Reserve Board intentionally tightened up the money supply in order to increase the amount of foreign investment back into the United States. That was intentionally done, but what that did was it increased interest rates. That was the whole idea. If you increased interest rates in the United States, then more people will invest in the United States. But what that does is that it increases interest rates everywhere. It increases interest rates on the third world loan. So essentially, in order to benefit the first world powers, the third world loans just went out of sight in terms of the interest rates. We all know, if anybody's been involved in loans, what happened to interest rates around 79, 80. And the commodity prices, because there's a recession, fewer people can buy their products. And so the commodity prices go down at the same time that the interest rates are going up. So they're losing income at the same time that they're being made to pay more. And the IMF, we spent a fair amount of time the other day talking about the roots of the IMF. I won't have time to do that now, but that's essentially a UN-related organization that does, in this particular case, is involved with helping out third world countries with payments, short-term loans, and that sort of thing. Their policies in the early 80s were ones that were really based on the idea that the debt problem was primarily one of just short-term cash flow. So their solution was to give them more money. So they convinced banks, as well as they made loans themselves to third world countries, so they could pay off their previous loans. In the meantime, interest rates are still high. In 1983, 79 cents on every dollar loan to third world countries was necessary just for the payment of interest on previous loans. So between 1980 and 1988, the third world debt went from a total of about $600 billion to now it's $1.2 trillion. It has doubled in the last 8 years. That's partly because of the interest rates going up and non-payment, but it's also due to new loans. What does that do? Yes?
Are the loans primarily dollar denominated?
They're essentially all in the international market. Essentially, the dollar is the current foreign exchange. I mean, that is what you use. And so essentially everything has to be paid in dollars, which gets into a whole other problem, which I haven't even gone into, which has to do with if they can't get enough of their exports sold to get foreign currency, they can't pay it off because they don't have dollars. I mean, that's another problem, which is a little bit more minor than some of the others. But yeah, it's dollars, the basic exchange. How many of you were here the other day? Most of you, I think, are new, aren't you? You were here. Yeah, it's only one person. I know a number of people were leaving that were here. Okay, well, I guess we're going to end up going through repeating a lot
of this.
Don't
worry about that for me.
Okay.
I can listen to it.
All right. I just wanted to be sure. We can spend more time on this than I planned to then, if we want to. Wendy?
This is pretty extreme and disastrous, what you're describing. Were people along the way saying, wait a minute, look at what's going on? It looks like the IMF, as you described it, saw something was wrong and just came up with an idea that may actually make
they didn't see a problem, really. I mean, it was a problem. The problem was is that if everybody defaulted, then it would be a problem for us. So they did see a problem, yes, but their response to it was one of, probably their first priority would be to say, we need to save the international banking system. And so in order to do that, you keep the money supply turning over. You keep interest coming back in. There's a way in which it's more important for banks to simply be receiving the interest payments than to really even know if the principal will ever be paid. It's a matter of the way the whole system works. So that's the way they, their perspective, and in order to do that, I mean, actually they did a really good job of that, of keeping that going. And, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, then they were very successful. Let me just briefly say, what does that mean, though, for the people, for a common person in a country? Is this just simply some matter of shuffling paper and dollar figures around across the world between banks and governments and that sort of thing, or does it really have an effect? It has a tremendous amount of effect on people. The third world is in the worst depression since the 30s for them, and a lot of people don't realize that. That the although there has been pretty remarkable economic growth in some countries, there's been, in most countries you can say there's been some economic growth, but the difference between economic growth in the developing countries as opposed to the industrialized nations is drastically different. The difference, if I can remember this off the top of my head, in the last 20 years, I think it is, in the first world nations, per capita income has increased about $2,000 per person, or 10, in the last 10 years, real dollars, not including inflation. And in the third world, it's $120. So basically, even if there was a little bit of growth, the disparity is growing greater. And it also means really disastrous effects in terms of cuts. Because what happens is that the IMF goes in and says, okay, we will help you renegotiate a loan, but in order to for us to give you this loan, you have got to agree to, and they list. And they're called adjustment programs, and they're all designed to increase their exports and decrease their imports. Well, how do you do that? That's like you and your own personal budgeting increasing your income and trying to decrease your expenses. So what that means is that these nations are forced to cut back on jobs. The Dominican Republic is one example where in 1 year 12,000 government sector jobs were cut because of IMF policies. Wages go down for the same reason. You have to save on expenses. Cuts in health and social programs very often, and food subsidies very often. Health clinics have closed. Infant mortality rates in some countries are going up again after having declined over the last 15 or 20 years, which is a major, infant mortality rate is the number of deaths of children in the first year of their life. And that's used as a prime indicator of sort of health and standard of living. Food subsidies were often used in third world countries for basic food products. Those have often been cut, and food prices have gone sky high. And imports, there have been controls on imports, so things are purposely sold at high prices so that fewer people can buy them, so that the imports are cut down on. And also, when you're trying to push for exports, you don't put pollution controls on things, you don't worry about rainforests, and you can go to different parts of the third world now, and even in fairly rural areas, there's just there are environmental disasters in terms of the pollution, things being pumped into rivers, no pollution on factories, controls on factories, those kinds of things. So that's generally what the problem is. Are there any questions about that? A little more time than I planned to, but at least that gives you some idea. Okay. Let's look briefly then at what are some of the proposals we're solving this and what are some of the things that are involved. I should end by saying two things to end this part. I think it's 18. For the first time in history, what the debt crisis has led to is that the third world is making a net transfer of resources to the first world. In other words, if you take all resources that go from the first world to the third world nations, and that includes grants, foreign aid, purchases, all those kinds of things, and then you take all of the resources that are going from the third world back to the first world in terms of loan payments and purchases and all those kinds of things, the net transfer, the net result is that the poor in the world are paying the wealthier. In 1984, there was $18 billion transfer, it was $26 billion in 85, and it was $30 in 86. It's going up. That amount of money is the amount that they are losing in compared to what we're getting. And that's documented stuff, so it's... And I think to say, too, that the title of the first session was Who Was to Blame? And I think we usually blame it simply on the irresponsible of the third world governments. And I think a lot of responsibility does lie there. There's no doubt about that, especially the sort of elite in those particular countries. But I think it's especially important when we start looking at solutions to understand that certainly I and a number of other people would say that a great share of the responsibility has to go to both banks who made irresponsible loans, as well as the multilateral agencies like the IMF and Western governments who have continued to sort of grasp onto a policy that has made the situation worse over the last 10 years. And I will say I don't blame it. I think the Reagan administration has made it worse and has certainly not addressed the problem, but the recession that led to a good part of the problem was in 79, that was part of Carter administration, so it's not something that I'm blaming on.
Would other first world countries be especially responsible as well?
Yeah, I mean, essentially the IMF has 151 members in it, of nations. But the voting power is based on one's economic power. So the United States has 20% or so of the voting power. The seven largest, the industrial powers, and that's Japan, Canada, West Germany, Great Britain, United States, I'm not sure where the other couple are without looking it up, control 54% of the voting power of the IMF. So they're the ones that determine those policies. The other 144 nations have not near as much control over what's happening. So yeah, I'm not trying to say it's all the U.S., but it is still true that even though the economic power of the United States has fallen in the last 15 years, that the United States still is the one most important influence in all of this. And the fact that our debt, ironically, we're the largest debtor country in the world. See, our debt is equal to all of this together. And our debt keeps interest rates up. So our debt really hurts third world countries. I mean, it's not so simple as just to say
that. We need their money to come in for our debt.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. Yeah. You were going to say something?
I'm surprised the number is as low as it is, with $1.2 trillion of debt.
Oh, the transfer?
This is only 2.5% of that right. Total debt number. Right. I would think we'd be fairly close to the debt service, which must be well in excess of $100 billion.
No, because there is a lot of money that's pumped into development projects in the third world. That would be the reason.
The offsetting number.
Yeah. And again, as I said, this is the first time in the 80s, is the first time in history that that's ever happened. It's always been a net transfer to third world, at least in the modern world. Yeah.
What does IMF stand for again?
The International Monetary Fund. It was created after World War II. I mean, who obviously set it up? It was set up by the six, well, four or five of the nations that control it. I mean, it was set up by the Allies after World War II, essentially to set up an international economic system that is still really controlled by the Western world. Going through and getting us to think about if we were going to try to approach this problem without getting any kind of technical solutions, what would be our concerns, what would be our criteria, our principles for the things that we would want to try to address. I think for the sake of time, I will skip actually doing that, but ask you to think about that. You know, what would be the most important things? In other words, who should pay? The title of this session is Who Pays? And it's purposely in that tense to say that I think right now the people who are really paying are the poor in the third world. More than anyone else, a lot of people are paying. But now the question is, who should pay for it? Because somebody's got to pay for it, essentially. It's the loans are never going to be paid back in full. I think almost everyone's accepted that. So now it's a matter of how do we deal with the situation.
I don't know anything about economics. What would be the consequences of just saying, okay, let's cancel everything out, we're all even?
Okay. Well, can you hold that question? Yeah. Because some of the stuff I want to look at is looking at various sort of scenarios that people have proposed. And let me just say, this is going to be very brief, and we're not going to be able to go into this in great detail, but it'll give you an idea, and then I would invite you, if you have an interest, to go back and look at through some of this other stuff that can go into it in detail. But maybe it at least will give you some idea if the next time you pick up something and read it, you can at least remember some of that stuff and think seriously about maybe taking some. There's one bill in Congress right now that I'd like to talk about too. The quick answer to your question is that there's just differing opinions on that. Some people have said that with some adjustments, not the whole thing just completely written off, that the banking system could withstand a fairly major chunk of that being written off. And of course others would say, you know, this would be, you know, threaten the stability of our entire banking system. I think most of the solutions have, they're taken seriously. Well, let me back up. Most of the solutions I would take seriously would include some write-off and then some other kinds of ways of dealing with that. So, let me just run down some of the solutions that have been proposed, and then I got some hand. I didn't expect this many people, so this isn't going to do us much good, but I have a few here that we can look at in terms of what the Debt Crisis Network proposes, and then I still would like to take at least a couple minute look at sort of the longer term look at this. There are a number of solutions that come within the system, within the financial system, and most of those are similar to what has been done in the past with maybe some slight revisions. The Baker Plan, named after James Baker, our U.S. Treasurer, the Secretary of Treasury, basically does that it's a matter of saying we wanted, I think his proposal was $29 billion more in loans, with a little bit more strict controls over where it goes and really making sure that it increases economic growth and coming at it from that point. Still the idea being our system works, all we gotta do is get some more economic surplus in there, some more capital, and get things rolling and making sure that growth happens and we'll get this whole thing solved. Others have proposed the slightly more extended role of the financial system. The Brandt Commission is out of Germany, looked at this a few years ago, and basically proposed, again, some net transfer of resources, but primarily from the International Monetary Fund, putting more money from the International Monetary Fund into countries at low interest rates, as well as some financing from banks. But very importantly, they also called for stabilizing the commodity prices, for stabilizing prices on the international market. There has, for a number of years, there's been calls from third world countries and others concerned that we need to stabilize those prices on which those countries depend, those products on which they depend. And the first world has always resisted that, saying we want a free market, basically. And the problem is that it's not really a free market, because the first world can really has a lot more influence by tightening or opening up the money supply and other kinds of economic influences they can take to really have some influence over those prices. So the third world has very little security in terms of that price system. Other people, a guy named Felix Roatan, who was the person who sort of bailed New York City out in the early 70s, or at least his design helped, has proposed that there be a new international credit agency, and things would come through that and it would be democratically run, that there would be not this IMF kind of structure in that. Senator Bradley proposed a system where you would decrease the interest rates by 3%, you would decrease the principal by 3% over about a 3-year period, so that you would write off some of it, then you would decrease the interest rates, and then you would renegotiate them for a longer term. So they didn't have to pay them off in 5 years, and they'd pay them off in 10, say, for example, instead. And a number of proposals include all these different things. Proposals that have come from the third world themselves have included things like lowering interest rates, rescheduling longer term loans, shifting the IMF policies, stabilizing the prices again, as we just talked about. And essentially, they've said in principle that we have made tremendous economic adjustments in the last 15 years. Now it's time for the banks to do that. That they say that we will not sacrifice the social conditions in the country anymore for servicing the debt, and you know, that they want to try to find ways that they can do that. Were you going to ask? Yeah.
What does military spending have to do with that? Wouldn't we save an awful lot of money if everybody's buying so many arms?
In fact, that's in one of the proposals that I'm getting to. It would make a tremendous amount of difference. A lot of the money, both in the third world and the first world, is going into that, and that really does make a lot of difference. I'm going to wait until I get to that, and then we'll go through it. Another part of proposals have been debt equity swaps, and that's a relatively new idea, at least a relatively new thing that's being used. And what that is, I'll write it up, is if a bank has a loan. Okay, what they do is they sell their debt, to, let's say in this case, a transnational corporation. So some big company, let's say that Bolivia, and we're talking about, say, let's just say $1 million of loan in this case. Some transnational corporation that has interest in Bolivia would buy the debt. In other words, but they would pay for it at the market rate, which right now is anywhere from 40 to 60% of the loan. So in other words, we're saying everyone's recognizing that these loans aren't worth $1 million because they're never going to be paid. Okay? So let's say 50% in this case. So let's say $500,000. All right, this transnational corporation pays the bank $500,000. The bank gets at least half of their principal back. What the transnational corporation does is, and this is all worked out with Bolivia, they then say, we will invest, we want you to pay us in Bolivian currency, See, and this is one of the big advantages because they don't have to worry about getting dollars. Anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million, they'll try to negotiate still getting as close to the original loan as they can get. And that we will then invest that money in something in Bolivia. In other words, we will either buy up a business that's struggling, or we'll start a new business. And there's several advantages to that. First of all, they don't have to worry about getting money, dollars. Secondly, it promotes economic growth within the country. The problem, what do you think the problem is that most of the third world countries are getting really uptight about? Absolutely. I mean, it's these transnational corporations already control so much of the economy of these countries, and now, in order to pay off their debt, they're going to even have that much more control. Now, one proposal, in fact, there's already been one, and it's in Bolivia, as a matter of fact. One thing for debt equity swaps that some people are really excited about are environmental debt equity swaps. And what happened was is that just this past year, the Conservation International, which is a big environmental group, raised $650,000. They paid off the bank that Bolivia owed $650,000 to, and then they went to Bolivia and said, okay, we will write off the entire debt if you agree to start these environmental controls in your country. And they've done it, and it seems to be working so far. The problem is there's real limits to how much of the debt can be done that way, because you can't find enough transnational corporations, even if you wanted to do it that way, to take up all the debt, and you certainly can't find enough environmental groups that are going to come up with a $1.2 trillion to put environmental controls on the rest of the world.
What recourse does Conservation International have if Bolivia says, hey, this is old stuff and cuts out?
I'm not sure about the details of that contract, but I think they still have legal control over that loan, but essentially they are writing off the payments periodically as long as the controls are actually instigated. That's my understanding. I don't. If anybody else knows more about that.
It's monitored closely then, I suppose.
I would imagine they would be, yeah, if they're really serious about it. If they put $650,000 in it, I'd certainly monitor it pretty closely, yeah. Let me just move on then to proposal by the Debt Crisis Network. First of all, our Xerox machine around here is hopeless at this point. I'll just let at least a few people, you can just pass those around and maybe three or four people can look on, and I'll just run through these. But basically they propose a combination of measures. And this little book goes into these in much more detail. This is just a sort of a listing of them. But basically they see that the poorest nations, most of which are in Africa, the majority of whom are in Africa, to write off the debt completely. They argue that that kind of write-off can be handled very easily. Maybe I should even say that a lot of people argue that the banks have made a tremendous amount of profit off of these loans. I didn't say that before. We talked about that the other day. The banks have not suffered. They're right now in a tight situation in terms of the loans, but they have made, for instance, Citicorp, which is one of the larger ones, made 20% of their profits a few years ago just on the country of Brazil. They have made a tremendous amount of profit off of these, and a lot of people are saying, look, the debt's been paid. If you really look at the profits of the banks over the last 8 years, we've essentially paid the debt in terms of what you have gained by the higher interest rates and other economic factors. So that's something to keep in mind. They call for, anyway, writing off those debts, for making new loans, if there are new loans, to make those only to countries whose human, they want to tie loans to human rights, and say, you know, there's certain international agreement about certain kinds of countries that are violation of human rights. So that's
who is promulgating these?
This is the Debt Crisis Network, which is a coalition of groups that's based in Washington, D.C., that was organized. I'm not sure how long they've been in existence. It includes several different church bodies, as well as Quakers, Bread for the World, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, Methodist Board of Global Ministries, the World Policy Institute. And that's just a partial listing. There's other groups involved too. Okay, then also for other countries for who are a little more developed and not as poor as some of the others, to revise IMF programs to place an emphasis on development programs that create jobs, advance health, housing, education, and other basic needs, narrow the gap between the rich and poor, and manage natural resources. And they say that can be done. That if you really are careful about the projects that are funded, that you can really do that. But at this point, you've got all over the third world half-built dams and even some nuclear power plants that don't operate. Joel Muggy was telling us about a nuclear power plant built by Westinghouse in the Philippines that's built on a fault. But Westinghouse has already been paid. Now the Philippines owes the IMF all this money for a nuclear power plant that'll never be used. So things like that. They want to tie, this goes back to what somebody was saying before about what, when we had up here the debt service ratio. They want to tie the amount that any one country pays on their debt to their export earnings. In other words, you would take your total amount of exports and then you would take 10% of that, and that's what you would pay each year. Now Peru's already done that. They said we can't pay any more than 10% a year. So they've done that. They've tied it and they've just done that themselves. Now they're getting some repercussions from the international community for it. But that's the proposal that these people and others are making. There are other things there too in terms of finally just to reform the IMF and democratize it. But generally what they're talking about is a combination of writing off some of the loans and then trying to revise the programs and development policies for everyone, and then having a certain amount of aid that would go in for economic development as well. So that's that. And then finally, this particular section, I just want to mention a bill that's in Congress right now that some people are fairly excited about. It doesn't solve the whole problem, but at least it's the best, sort of, would take a major step. It's the PEAS bill, the World Trade Expansion Development and Financial Stability Act of 1988. In summary, the bill would create a special agency of the IMF that would buy the debt from the banks at the market rate. So essentially the first part of the process would be what we just talked about. And that whole market rate would be negotiated. And then the IMF would then serve as the loan agency. And financially, evidently, it's worked out so that IMF would be able to do that. Essentially, they wouldn't pay the banks right immediately. They would buy, but they would then, the banks would be owed money by the IMF and not by third world governments anymore. The IMF would then pass on the savings from the market rate deduction to the third world countries. So, for instance, is this making any sense? Okay. So instead of the transnational here, we have the IMF. So the IMF promises, essentially, in a way, what happens is the IMF takes out a loan from the bank for $500,000, if you're talking about the same amount here. that's what's negotiated. And then the IMF passes that on to Bolivia and says, okay, now you don't owe $1 million anymore, you owe $500,000. And then the IMF would pay the bank as those loans come in. The banks, the advantage is, you're going to say, well, why are the banks going to do that? Well, they're going to do it, number one, so they have at least some money coming in. But they're given quite favorable conditions upon for tax laws and that sort of thing as far as how they can write off their losses. They can extend it over a period of time, and there's a lot of details about that. So there's a great incentive for the banks to do it. So the banks really win, in a way. At least they don't lose as much as they thought they might. The banks don't, the loans aren't defaulted on, and the third world countries have greatly reduced debt. And if anybody, I have a description of the bill if anybody's interested in looking at that.
Do you have the number on
it? It is, no, I don't. It might be an earlier part of this. I don't think that would really matter.
Do you want to write your company or something about
it? Yeah, I would certainly encourage people to look at
it. Who's the sponsor?
Pease, who is, where is he from? I can tell you, just a second. Don Pease is a Democrat from Ohio.
P-E-A-S-E,
right. A representative, he's not in the House. So, and I just found out about that. This was just introduced in Congress a couple months ago. I didn't even know about this until a couple weeks ago.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It seems like that floating rate of interest really worked real badly in all these countries, right? Has there ever been talk about retroactively taking all that top interest off that wasn't expected in the beginning and subtracting that from the total debt?
That's essentially what the rationale is for some, like Bradley's plan and some of these others, really, is to say that the banks really benefited greatly mm-hmm. from that, and the banks were actually involved in some ways, the economic policies that created the recession to start with. So they really benefited already from that. It really hurt the third world. So it's used as a rationale for, in an economic sense, mm-hmm. to say it's not just a matter of we're giving you something here, mm-hmm. or that the banks are losing. They're trying to argue that it really is already, the cost has already been shared, or should be shared in that way. Yeah, it's a good point, but that's really is the rationale for a lot of them. Jody.
I remember, I don't know whether you get the session or not, but when a couple of weeks ago when the Brazilian theologian Walter Altman was here, he did a part of a session on the Brazilian debt.
Yeah,
He made two major points, among a number of others, but two that stick in my mind. One was that Brazil has already paid back $20 billion more than the principal
right.
of what it is that the U.S. has loaned to Brazil, right?
That's good.
And the second was that nowhere in the Western theological community has there ever been a reprint of Martin Luther's treatise on usury. So he's translating it and doing a commentary on it. It's his next theological project. And he says it's incredibly radical.
Huh. Well, the church is finally starting to get involved in this a little bit. The United Church of Christ, which is a church that I'm affiliated with, has passed nationally in our body a whole resolution on the debt crisis, which essentially calls for a lot of the reforms we've just talked about. The Lutherans sponsored a conference in Mexico last year on the debt crisis primarily, in which American theologians and pastors and church leaders gathered with Latin American church leaders as well as economists and business leaders, and we looked at all systems.
What happens if this isn't somehow checked or somehow changed? What happens?
What
How
happens?
Long can this go on? And, you know, it's...
Well,
And where does our debt figure into all of this? The U.S.
Okay. The debt, our debt figures in several ways, the most important of which is simply that it it keeps interest rates high for a number of reasons. The main reason is that in order for us to even deal with our debt at all, we need foreign investment into the United States. We need those resources here. And in order to attract that investment, interest rates need to be at a relatively comparatively high point. I mean, they've dropped a lot before, but they could even be lower without that particular debt. So that's the main way in which that influences the third world debt. I don't want to try to set myself up as somebody who really knows what would happen. If it continues, basically, in the manner in which it is going now, if the Western world sort of refuses to really make some major changes, probably what's going to happen is that the third world countries are going to get together and organize. And I'm not so sure that'd be a bad thing at all. That's already been called for by several leaders, first by Fidel Castro, but at this point none of that has really happened. But that's essentially what's being talked about now, and if they can get together as a group and come to some kind of agreement about demands, then people are going to have to start listening to them, because they're going to all say, we're not going to pay any of this until you agree to this. And that's most likely what's going to happen before it goes a whole lot further. At least that's what some people are predicting. If it continues, the problems in terms of the people in the third world is going to continue and get worse. Yeah?
I came in late, so you may have answered this already, but I just want to get through with the scope of the problem. What, take a major bank like Chase, for example, what fraction of their total resources are involved in these kinds of dicey debts?
I don't know about Chase. Well, actually,
I just took Chase as an item. All right. It's large of that magnitude.
I can tell you exactly. As of 2 days ago. Tuesday, July 26th, Chase Manhattan. Well, shoot, it doesn't give their precision.
Well, it's any, you
know. Okay, well,
how about total U.S.?
Their total loan portfolio in 88 for third world is $6.4 billion.
Yeah, but that's
I don't know what that total percentage is.
Yeah.
I do know that for the six, I can tell you that the six major leading banks in the country, I think it's 85% of their capital would be let me back up. It's the six major banks, and their outstanding loans to Latin America is about $45 billion. And that represents, I think, about 85% of their capital. Something like that.
So if they ate the loans, they'd go under. Makes sense.
If you completely wrote them off like that, then probably some of them would, yeah. But other people, try to find a way in which I forgot we'd end at 10 till I was thinking about 10 8.
Do you think some of the root of this problem comes from just racism or viewing other countries as perhaps not being equal in terms of us and as human beings? It just seems like there's such advantage taken.
Yeah. I think a lot of this stuff has to do with institutional racism. Yeah. Let me just end by saying, because it was more important to probably give the basis of this, and we essentially wrapped up the debt crisis, I just want to say that I really do think that the long-term issue here is one of the whole international economic system, and wanted to at least talk very briefly about some of that in terms of the IMF, the way that controls the economic system and other international agencies, our trade policies, the price control system, all those kinds of things, the development models that we use, the way in which we control how countries that we give loans to have to manage their economic system. We give them very little autonomy to do that in their own systems. We've told countries they have to sell nationalized corporations and things like that. We didn't have a chance to get into that. That's okay. But I would just invite you to really think about that stuff. And a really great book on that is this one, Bread and Justice Toward a New International Economic Order. And it's written very much from a faith and theological perspective. And the U.S. Catholic Bishop's letter also, again, calls for the same kind of stuff.